As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming's arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant content in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at the revenue recovery for MGM Resorts.
Plus, the UK residential renovation gets a boost from the housing hot streak.
But first, let's talk about travel. Are you going anywhere for the rest of the summer? Are you making any plans for the winter? And what does that mean for the airline stocks, hotel stocks, the whole thing? Joining us now, Bloomberg Intelligence senior airlines analyst George Ferguson. George, this past week, in a surprise move, the EU didn't stop U.S. citizens from coming into the EU and be able to vacation there. They're going to reevaluate in the next 2 weeks. What's intercontinental travel like right now?
So I think that was one of the few good news points on transatlantic travel. So transatlantic travel is, I would say, a hodgepodge of requirements and regulations right now. The most befuddling to me, I think, is that the U.S. has excluded a lot of our key partners from Europe, the Germans, the English and such, from even coming here, quarantine or not. But we can go there to some of the countries, and some of them we have to quarantine, some not. Usually in the southern hemisphere, the ones that like and need travel the most have the least restrictions. But we're starting to see, a major spike in some of the virus activity down there. So it makes me wonder how long that's going to last, or how long U.S. Travelers going to want to go there. So I just call it a ridiculous hodgepodge right now, really hard to figure out, very country dependent.
Where are we just in U.S. domestic capacity right now, George? It seems like there's more planes on the ground and in the air. Where are we in terms of that capacity?
Yeah, so U.S. capacity, as we sort of near the end of the summer travel season, some of the low-cost carriers are even flying more than they did in 2019. Hmm. Lots of carriers are, I would say, within 10 or 15% of 2019 levels. And this is just on leisure travel. So I'd say from a leisure travel perspective, from what we've heard from a lot of them, is that they're back to 2019 levels. So it's been quite a nice bounce back on leisure in the U.S. and the domestic market.
Does that hold up with Delta?
Well, I think there's a couple of problems. I think Delta is a bit of a problem. I seem to think we're not going to ever go back to the lockdowns that we saw in 2020. I think we understand the virus too much. There's some people that just won't, refrain as much as they would maybe last March when they didn't understand what was at risk. So I think Delta does take some demand off the table. But I think more importantly is the business travel, right? I think the leisure's closing. The heavy leisure season's closing. Kids are going back to school. It's going to make it harder for mom and dad to get away with the kids. If you don't have kids, I guess, it's easier. And companies, though, starting to push back that return to office. I think employees need to be back in the office before the companies really flesh out what travel policies are going to be. And so I think without that sort of return to office or pushing it back, I think we're not going to see that business travel for longer. And I think that really hurts the fall season and winter season this year because of that. And I think then Delta has an effect on that.
And we're talking about the Delta variant, not Delta Airlines.
Good point.
And
good point.
Airline conversation. I'm sure the folks at Delta appreciate clarifying that. George, all right. So it's interesting. People were hoping by this time we'd have you know, a more vibrant transatlantic, a more vibrant maybe intercontinental European travel, but this Delta variant has really put a wrinkle in that. Are the airlines, are they preparing for a slower than expected kind of third and fourth quarter? Are they guiding down?
So as of right now, we don't see that. We've just finished earnings season. Most of them were pretty upbeat on booking trends. There were some of them that would readily admit that business travel is a short booking window, meaning business travelers usually book within a couple of weeks. And so they said, we don't have a sense for where business is going, and we do see a taper in leisure. But most of them were pretty upbeat. So I don't see them guiding yet, but we're watching closely right now.
Are there enough flight attendants and pilots to do stuff?
There are challenges with labor, like everywhere else in the economy. Pilots are very sort of, I don't know what the right term, maybe sticky, sort of labor force, because they've got such a specialized skill set. And the challenge there is more getting them trained and having them current to fly the equipment that you've got at the airline at this point, right? And some airlines cut part of the fleet, so they might not need pilots that fly XYZ, but they need pilots that fly PDQs. And so they got to get them trained and move them to what they have in the fleet. Others haven't been flying for a while. That's a little bit of a challenge. That's a challenge for the full service carriers, the United, the Deltas, the American. The low cost guys, they're having a problem because I think they're trying to take a lot of market share here. And we're seeing companies like Spirit, I think, really push the amount of capacity they put in the marketplace without having the appropriate levels of reserve airplanes and other, and pilots that aren't that are in reserve, ready to meet, the need if they have a weather event or something like that. And that's hurt them. We've seen that recently. So I think the low-cost guys are pushing it. The full-service guys do have a genuine sort of training problem.
Okay, George. Thank you very much. George Ferguson, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Airlines Analyst.
All right, coming up on the program, we look at which mining and metals companies are best positioned for the transition to a low-carbon world.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we spend a lot of time on this program talking about ESG investing, environmental, social, governance. It's growing in popularity. This time, we want to take a look at how the metals and mining industry fares under this analysis. For that, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst Shaheen Contractor. Just at first blush, Shaheen, it would seem to me the metals and mining companies might not score very well on ESG. Is that a poor bias on my part?
Metals and mining have always been sort of the traditional, just like oil and gas, sort of the traditional folks who have faced a lot of ESG slack. But I think the benefit of that is they picked up their game fairly early on in the process. And I think we're seeing a number of miners sort of ramp up. A number of them have set these carbon reduction goals over the last year or so, I would say. Probably something I haven't seen before.
So You kind of rank them, like, right? So you go over 46 metal and mining companies. Before we get into like who scored well and who didn't, what were your criteria? Because a lot of times I feel like companies say one thing and do another, but even more importantly, they say like carbon intensity versus, versus my own operations. And those make a difference in how you measure it.
Absolutely. And so our ranking is really looking at these carbon reduction goals. So these are our BI carbon scores. And what we're really doing is we're assessing companies on two pillars. So one is a historic pillar, which looks at sort of reduction trends over 5 years and along with the current intensity. And the second is more sort of forward-looking. It's where here we're quantifying these forward-looking reduction goals and really comparing it to a temperature-aligned benchmark. So at the end of the day, we're just seeing, who's aligned with the Paris goal, who's ambitious enough. To your point, of course, they're tricky, which is why we've come up with this standardized way of doing things.
So there's three ways to kind of measure stuff. Like one is scope one and two, which are basically the carbon reduction using your own power, so you're using less. The other is the types of energy that you're using. So instead of using coal, maybe you use solar. And then the other is the products that you produce and cutting that. Are any of these guys tackling scope three? Because in the oil community, scope three is so hard to do because it's basically trying to tackle emissions in like jet fuel and what you're driving in your car.
I think scope three for things like oil and gas is the elephant in the room. I think if we go beyond that to other sectors, it isn't so much of a focus. I think the one company that comes to my mind that is tackling scope three is, if I remember right, it's Newmont. But again, other than that, it's largely just operational emissions, because I think if you, you know, you have transportation, oil and gas, that's really where scope three is the elephant in the room. But when it comes to metals and mining, we're not there yet.
So Shaheen, for a metals and mining company, what do they actually do to improve their ESG kind of footprint, if you will?
So, you know, for it really depends on the metal produced, and it's just so diversified. I'll give you the example of aluminum. So aluminum is, again, just one of the most carbon-intensive industries, and over there it's things like increasing scrap-based production, which is much less carbon-intensive, and also decarbonizing the power sector, for example, because aluminum just uses a lot of electricity. But it varies for different metals, so it varies literally from company to company, mine to mine.
But to that point, you take a look at the carbon scores that are the worst, and that's going to like Rio and Glencore. Is that a coal thing?
So Rio Tinto has a fair amount of operations in aluminum. And just the way the score is designed, aluminum being so carbon intensive has to reduce emissions by a lot more than other diversified miners. So by default, they automatically tend towards the lower end of their score, of our scorecard. Again, just because they're so much more carbon intensive than any other metal. And Rio Tinto having sort of an arm in that. Would weigh down on them, just like any other company, like you would see Hindalco, you would see Russell towards the bottom.
So, Shaheen, is there any regionality to this? Are European domiciled companies, do they do better? Because it seems to me I've ESG concerns or ESG issues are more pronounced in Europe than perhaps, or more advanced than they are in the U.S. So do we see that in some of the results and some of the performance of these companies?
So, Paul, you're right. I think for most sectors, we do see this regional distance where Europe is leading. I think for metals and mining, I didn't see it just because everything is so globally spread, like Africa, South America, all the operations are just diversified. I think for metals and mining, it was more by sub-industry. And what I mean by that is base metal companies had far more goals than precious metals. Again, base metal, example, aluminum is much more carbon intensive, which is why it's more material for operations, again, which is why companies are setting these goals. Precious metals, not so carbon intensive.
Yeah,
less of a focus, less of a priority.
Yeah, it feels like copper, gold kind of get a little bit of a easier pass on that.
They do, and they should, because it's not that carbon intensive. It comes down to sort of costs and things like that.
Are investors rewarding these companies for that?
So, you know, that's a great question, and I still have to do the analysis for metals, but I can give you what I did as an example for utilities, where we saw that, you know, companies with higher BI carbon scores were more likely to be held in an ESG fund. So clearly ESG investors are prioritizing these issues. Now, I would wait to see what kind of analysis that leads to metals and mining, but that's what we had for utilities. So definitely something prioritized for at least the resource intensive, environmentally heavy sectors.
Yeah, like metals and mining. I'm just wondering, I know this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue for managers, for board members, for shareholders, this focus on ESG in addition to, you know, the income statement and the balance sheet and things like that.
Yeah.
In the metals and mining space, what's the sense you get from management in terms of their commitment?
I think metals and mining is, again, like an industry that's just been early exposed to ESG just because it's amongst the resource-intensive sectors.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one thing I've been seeing from metals and mining companies is an increasing focus on safety, so things like fatality rates, incident rates, and I'm seeing an increasing number of companies that sort of executive compensation and tie this back to things like safety and to some extent also emissions. So, you know, that compensation incentive gives you a direct sort of monetary push to do these things. So yeah, definitely more of a focus from that.
Yeah, it's sort of like they had to have the right to operate for so long in different countries that they couldn't mess it up, that they already have in some ways better practices, more conditioned, I guess. All right, Shaheen, thanks a lot. Shaheen Contractor joining us, Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst.
Coming up on the program, we look at the revenue recovery for MGM Resorts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg. Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Well, as you wind up having the Delta variant wreaking havoc pretty much all across the world, how does that affect different sectors? That's what we've been working on throughout Bloomberg Intelligence. One particular area I want to focus on now is the gaming stocks like MGM, Las Vegas Sands. What's the implication there? So let's welcome Bloomberg Intelligence senior gaming and lodging analyst Brian Egger. All right, so Delta variant's running rampant here. Who's getting hurt the most?
So I think if you look at, you know, if you look at MGM as kind of a proxy for the industry, certainly like in the second quarter, and thinking about what that means, I would say, you know, the Macau market in Asia got hit particularly hard, where we're still at a half of 2019's pre-pandemic level of gaming activity. Part of that is because there was an outbreak in Guangdong province, which is a major feeder market for Macau, and that definitely affected some of the traffic inflow. That's been an ongoing issue for Macau and could be for a while until that resolves. When you move to the U.S., Las Vegas actually has been on a bit of an upswing and close to or back to pre-pandemic levels, and it benefited when the market went back to full resort occupancy back in June. And yes, the question going forward is whether or not the arrival of the Delta variant will affect what we expect it to happen, which is, you know, a big uptick in convention activity as we get to the fall months. And that we really have to watch and see carefully.
So what are the gaming companies and the big hotels telling the street about that convention business? Because when I think of Vegas, again, pretty much every time I've been to Vegas, it's been with a convention. Is that business going to come back in this year, or is the Delta pushing out until next year?
So the bookings, and again, a lot of this is happening, as you can understand, in real time, but the bookings business on the books for the fall and going into 22 have been actually quite strong. The real question is, as we approach the actual dates, depending on how companies adjust their travel policies, et cetera, whether or not that might result in cancellations. But at least the book of business going into this period, as of the company's most recent comments during the earnings season, were actually quite favorable.
So that leads me to my next question. How much cancellation can these guys stand?
Given the fact that, you know, I think the industry has weathered being with all casinos shut back in last March through June and has endured pretty significant capacity limitations, now that the market's back to full occupancy, I guess you could argue they've been stress tested quite well, notwithstanding what might happen with the Delta variant. So, you know, it is an issue. What has happened during the downturn is that 20% of Las Vegas room nights at a company like MGM that would normally be occupied by convention goers has been taken up by casino customers, which is a less attractive business. It's lower price. And the question is whether or not they have to go back to depending on that lower price casino customer, that leisure customer, if the convention activity is somehow disrupted.
All right, so we've done Macau. Maybe we'll go back there and Vegas. Now, how about the regional markets around the country? You know, they, I think they did a little bit better. They're less dependent upon that convention business. What's the outlook for some of the regional gaming?
Regional gaming outlook is actually quite strong. I mean, when we look at MGM in the second quarter, and we compare all these results to the second quarter of 2019 because most of these casinos were closed during the second quarter of 2020. When we look at that, the regional gaming revenue is actually up about 6% versus the second quarter of 2019, which is pretty impressive. And not only that, because the companies are still operating with significantly scaled back labor and marketing, they've seen some really significant margin improvement. So we're not only seeing a return to pre-pandemic levels of revenue in the regional markets, but also very strong margin gains and EBITDA flow through because of the fact that the cost base has been pared down so significantly during the pandemic.
Most other industries are dealing with worker shortages, a lot of input cost increases, wage increases, etc. How about these guys? You can go broad, but I was thinking more specifically the U.S. and like what do they do to margins? Like, how do they pass that on, etc.?
So I think what could happen, and it's something that companies have mentioned is an expense category that they're watching carefully, is although most of the hotel companies, for example, we follow, manage, and receive revenue or profit-based fees as a form of compensation for managing or franchising those hotels, there is a chance that the so-called house profit margins, the margins at the hotel owner level, could be under some pressure to the extent that we see rising labor costs. Now, of course, they're going into this period, just as we said, for the casino companies, having significantly reduced and right-sized their cost structure and their labor structure to accommodate what in many cases has been a smaller audience. So as occupancy begins to return, and as you see labor and staffing levels return to pre-pandemic levels, you know, this could be a cost issue we're going to have to watch to the extent that labor accounts for such a significant portion of the expense base of both hotel companies and casino companies.
Great stuff, Brian. Super appreciate it. Brian Egger, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Gaming and Lodging Analyst.
Coming up on the program, we check in on the buoyant UK housing market and look at how hybrid working model is impacting European real estate investment trusts.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Measuring the health of an economy, in that it's critical to understand the health of its housing market. Let's do that for the UK. At one point, housing market was on fire. The rental market was on fire. The stocks related to housing, building, construction were on fire. Are they still? Well, Eshan Torabali, a senior analyst from Bloomberg Intelligence for Business Services, joins us now. So just broad stroke real quick, where is the state of the housing market within the UK?
Hi there. So the housing market is still very hot, actually. It's continued to grow strongly, sort of rebounding from the pandemic. And that appears to be underpinned for the next few months in terms of looking at how the data is progressing. So, yes, still a very hot market.
All right. Let's talk about the repair, the maintenance, the improvement of existing housing stocks and apartments. I mean, that's also a hot sector in the U.S. as people remodel their home because they're going to be like, well, I've been living in this thing nonstop for a couple of years and who knows how much longer. So talk to us about that type of spending in the UK and maybe how some investors are looking for exposure.
Yeah, so I think it's exactly the same trend in the UK. So that spend fell off quite strongly at the beginning of the pandemic with lockdowns that we had here sort of in early 2020, but it's come back very, very strongly. The last data point, which is May, that we have for UK data is up 93%. So it is very, very strong year over year, but that's partly a reflection of last year's weakness. But I think you're right in terms of the trend and what's driving that. Partly there's pent-up demand from that lost sort of couple of months from the lockdown last year. Partly there's underlying strength in this kind of product, given we're in a pandemic and people are spending more time at home and they want to make their homes better, plus the fact people are not taking paid vacations abroad as much as they would normally do, so they have more money to plow into their houses. And then the final point, as we alluded to earlier, that when the housing market is strong, this is also good for repair and modeling, because the data shows over time that most people spend on their houses when they've just moved. So all of those things are all moving in the right direction currently.
I so well know that from moving during the pandemic as well. What stocks are most exposed and what's priced into that?
So the companies I look at which are exposed to this space are Travis Perkins, which is the UK's biggest building material distributor, Grafton, which is also in a similar market, and then finally Howden Joinery, which is the UK's biggest kitchen fitting company. So these companies are sort of, you know, linked into this trend. I would say they've recovered very well in terms of share price. So year to date, they've outperformed the general market by something like 20%. And it's been mirroring this sort of the underlying data. They've been raising guidance, et cetera. So I think a strong recovery is priced in terms of what's happened to the share prices. But from here, it looks like momentum from an earnings perspective is still pretty good. There's no reason to sort of be nervous about sort of the growth of renovation data or repair data, etc. So that there is, you know, they perform very well, but there's still more momentum to come, it seems.
Yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to go, because I think a lot of people here in the States, they're saying, you know, we do have a housing boom here, low mortgage rates, people, you know, moving out and wanting more space, and understanding that that's similar in the UK. The real question, though, is how long does it last? When are people going to be like, wait a minute, I don't want to live in the middle of nowhere or in the burbs. I'm going to be back in the city. What are some of your companies saying about that?
So I think it's a very good question, because I think in the short term, everyone has been focused on their cash flow and now the rebound that's coming through. So it's kind of sort of getting their business back on track in terms of opening their outlets or paying dividends and so on. So it's still very much about that. But I think the key risk, as you highlighted in the question, is how transient is this? Is this something that can last over the medium term, or is this something very much that's just going to last while the pandemic is kind of playing through, as it were? So once we all return to offices and so on over time with vaccines and so on, does that then lead to a sort of a fall off in this kind of demand that we're seeing? I think the other thing I would add to that is that house prices have been very strong here in the UK. So there's a risk that they're maybe too strong to support a longer term recovery. So there's a risk that maybe things have got a bit too expensive and that could stall any eventual recovery. But we're not there yet. And in the short term, it seems like everything is moving in the right direction. But there is that question mark over the medium term.
Thank you so much, Bloomberg Intelligence Business Services Analyst Ashan Torabali.
Let's turn to the world of REITs and the impact of a hybrid work world. The question is, on the other side of this pandemic, in a Delta world, what will the work living at home type of dynamic look like? And what does that mean for commercial real estate? For more, we welcome Sue Munden, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Property Analyst. So, Sue, what are the companies saying here as we try on a global scale to reopen?
Well, they're saying at the moment that their tenants are really just refurbishing their space to try and cope with more meeting rooms, more space to be able to have Zoom calls, and less space for desks. And they're busy doing that at the moment, but not really reducing their space requirements too much. I do think, though, that over the course of the next 18 months, maybe 2 years, as we all come back to work and we all settle down to a more hybrid pattern, that there may be some more profound impacts on the space that we're using and what the tenants really want.
To that point, before we get to like what they may want, I guess the question is, when do they make that decision? Because with so much uncertainty, like our lease is up at a certain point, does something have to be locked in? Like, what's the time frame for that?
Yeah, so yes, leases are important. In the UK, they can be quite long. In the continent, there may be 3 years or 9 years altogether, but with 3 or 6 year breaks. So it does vary enormously what the lease lengths are. But also, the thing is that the cost of your office is quite low in comparison with the cost of your staff, for example. And so it's probably not the immediate priority. You know, all the occupiers are saying they want to be able to attract talent, so they want a good place for their, you know, their staff to go. But at the same time, you know, if they wanted to cut their costs by 20%, they could sublet a very small portion of their property. So that's a decision that will come further down the line in the, you know, working through how we deal with a hybrid environment, hybrid working environment.
So the last time I was in London, admittedly, it was 2 years ago now. I was just amazed that despite Brexit and all the doom and gloom, all you could see around the City of London was cranes building new structures in the City of London, outside the City of London. What's the London real estate market like these days?
So actually, for offices, the supply of offices isn't that huge. I know we had Brexit, and you know, then we had the pandemic, and so construction has slowed down a lot for offices. There's a lot of home building going on, and I actually believe that you know, the sort of problems that we're facing here is that come 2030, that all the offices have to be what we call EPC compliant, which means that they have to be A or B ranked for climate change and their emissions and the energy that they consume. And not much of the London stock actually complies with that at the moment. So there is a big concern amongst the community, the office community, as to how much money they're going to have to spend to get their offices to that state. And I think what that's going to drive, one of the reasons, but there are others as well, it will drive a lot of the sort of obsolete space or the stranded assets, if you like, because they're not compliant, will be converted into residential or to other uses as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that will, you know, during that renovation process, they'll solve both the energy compliant problems as well as getting the property uses aligned more with demand, which is the big thing that we're facing at the moment.
So aside from longer term having to retrofit their offices to fit the climate rules, in an immediate basis in terms of trying to bring people back, you were starting to mention this before, but what are the souped up cool things that offices are going to try and do?
Well, they want more amenities in the properties. You know, they want some meeting space. And I think this mixed-use sort of campus style is really gaining some traction. British Land already has, you know, sort of campus style properties. You know, it's a bit like Canary Wharf, really, which I know you know well, which has a huge shopping center at the bottom, and it's got lots of residential towers now and as well as offices. So the ability to network physically as well as online is important. But the other thing is we're finding around Paris and London that there are sort of clusters of certain types of industry, office users. So there's the knowledge quarter, there's the life sciences quarter, there's, you know, the city, the financial quarter, and tech quarters, obviously, as well. And so the buildings and the communities there will move towards sort of attracting those employees. And I think that's something that we'll see a lot more of going forward. So much more mixed use. Places like London, central Paris has always been much better because it always had a lot of residential in it. But the City of London was, you know, I think we've spoken about this before, but the City of London, you know, is very much just offices. And they've already now said that they're going to allow planning for more residential. So I think it'll be switching buildings to a better use that has those amenities, that's, you know, near good transport networks, that is, you know, got good ventilation for well-being, that people can control their mental health. All those sorts of things are going to be really important going forward. And it will take a year or two, I think, for that to go through the system and for us to really understand how much office space is needed, but there'll be space needed for other things.
All right, Sue, thank you so much. We really appreciate that. Sue Munden, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Property Analyst. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.